Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Greek economic crisis and speak with Richard Parker, an economic advisor to the last Greek government of Papandreou and the current Greek government of Papademos. We will discuss the second EU-Greek rescue package that is close to agreement and whether or not we'll prevent further instability in the Eurozone where austerity measures have slowed growth. Then we'll get an analysis of why the Syrian capital, Damascus, has so far escaped the Syrian civil war that has raged in the countryside, with other cities such as Homs facing destruction. Bilal Saab, a visiting fellow in nonproliferation studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies, joins us. He has an article at CNN, Why Damascus Remains Eerily Calm. Then finally, we'll examine the latest outrage in Mexico's war against drug cartels that has so far killed over 47,500 Mexicans. The author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, Joan Grillo, joins us. He is a correspondent for Reuters who is covering the drug war in Mexico, and we will discuss the prison riot in which 44 members of the Gulf Cartel were bludgeoned and stabbed to death in a massacre that was a cover for a breakout escape of 30 prisoners from the ultra-violent Zetas drug gang. I'm now joined by Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's also a senior fellow in the Shorenstein Center, and his books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. He was an economic advisor to the previous Papandreou government in Greece and is an advisor to the current Greek government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Parker.
Nice to be with you, Ian.
And apparently they've been meeting in Brussels late into the night. I'm not even sure that they're still meeting. It's got to be awfully late in Brussels at this point. But apparently they're close to an agreement. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, that is my understanding. I mean, this happened in October when they went through a previous round of negotiations over the so-called 50% cut in the private sector initiative or private sector debt holdings of Greek bonds, and it happened in last July as well, too. This is a very serious set of issues for both sides, and necessarily this is going to go right down to the wire.
But apparently under the bailout terms, Greece is supposed to reduce its debt to 120% of GDP by 2020 from about 160% now. Apparently, in the haggling to and fro, they're down to about 126-129%. Is that that's what's happening right there?
That's what the current projected is, because they don't think they'll make the 120 right now, so they're allowing for some wiggle room up on the upside.
So what does that mean in terms of the bondholders taking a haircut? My understanding was originally they were prepared to take a 50% haircut. And what is required is something closer to a 90% haircut. And my understanding is that they're at about 70%. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, again, these are numbers that have room in them depending on how you're doing the calculations. And this has been one of the points of contention. I worked very closely with the prime minister and the financial team for the government of Greece on the October negotiations, which led to the original announcement of the so-called 50% haircut. And the banks were reluctant then to take a 50% haircut and came right back to the Greek negotiators with what I'll call ingenious ways of trying to make up on the fine print what they seem to be giving up in the headlines. And, you know, that's an ongoing struggle, which is, the banks don't like to write off these size losses. The European governments are torn because they want the bank's capitalization, the bank's financial health to improve. And, you know, the more they have to give up on these, the more it impairs their financial asset base. And so the European governments have been at times torn about just how much they wanted their own banks to take as a write-down in reality.
So the latest round of austerity measures and spending cuts that the Greek government is apparently agreeing to, and this is in the face of a $14.5 billion euro repayment of Greek debt due on March the 20th. I believe that what they're talking about in Brussels is a total of 172 billion, isn't it? something like that.
Yeah, that's the number that's being talked about right now, yeah.
Right. So, but at this point, the Greek government, who's already gone through austerity measures, is now talking about taking $1 billion generic medicine, switching to generic medicines in their healthcare, cutting overtime pay for hospital doctors, saving money on military procurement, and reducing the number of deputy mayors than their staff.
So, right.
I mean,
right.
What about the basic questions that, you know, because this has somewhat been racialized between the North and the South, the notion that right. the Germans are the thrifty, hardworking people and the Greeks are lazy and they don't pay their taxes. What about the criticisms that have been coming from German bankers recently about lots of shadow pensions and the rich don't pay their taxes? Because I understand the Greek government did put out a name and shame list of all the famous Greek sportsmen and celebrities, et cetera, that weren't paying their taxes.
Right. Well, look, I mean, this is a complicated issue. On the one hand, I've worked closely with the Greek government over the last 2.5 years, and there are several fundamental points. The Greeks, as a people, pay taxes. About a third of GDP is paid in taxes every year. That's higher as a percentage of GDP than the Americans pay. And so the idea that they don't pay taxes is wrong. What they don't pay is as much in income tax, both corporate and individual income tax, as the U.S. or other European countries do on average. And it is absolutely correct that Greece needs to become better at collecting income taxes, and that there is a lot of evasion, and that there is a broken both auditing system and also a judicial system for collecting taxes once taxpayer fraud or taxpayer evasion, illegal evasion, has been identified. So the Germans are right in that sense. The rest of Europe is right in the sense that the Greek tax collection and tax enforcement system needs to be very strengthened. The fact is, though, that the Greek government has not disagreed with that at any point and is moving rapidly to try to identify those taxpayers who are not paying and also to start the collection process. To date, they've been better at identifying who needs to pay taxes than they have been to collect the taxes, because it requires a fundamental reform of the judicial system. One proposal is that a whole separate tax court system, separate from the main court system, much like we have in the United States, be set up. And they're moving toward that, but it's not in place yet, and it's taking time. And there is obviously a lot of political resistance from people who are supposed to pay taxes. It is an ongoing struggle.
Well, how different is it then from the United States? The wealthy people in this country don't pay taxes, and we recently learned from Mitt Romney that he pays 15%, and that may have been news to a lot of Americans that the wealthiest, the hedge fund managers, only pay 15%. So, what's the comparison there?
Well, I mean, I think the comparison is that there is a lot of tax evasion in a lot of these countries. There is a lot of legal tax evasion, if you will. I mean, Romney's an example. I mean, no one's saying that what he did was illegal. It just happens to smack of gross inequity that someone that wealthy could pay that low a tax rate. This is the old Buffett versus Buffett secretary argument. And, you know, I'm very sympathetic to the idea that these kinds of legal forms of tax reduction should be removed. Greece is in a crisis that is different than the U.S.'s crisis, because the U.S. is still the world's largest economy and the dollar is still the world's reserve currency. And so the United States has a lot of ability to borrow in the open markets. In fact, as you know, when the Fed lowered interest rates and some of the credit agencies started to threaten and actually did lower the rating of federal bond or federal paper, money rushed into the United States rather than rush out, which would normally be the circumstance. But that has to do with America being America. Greece is not on the same scale. Greece's economy is about, you know, 1.5% of the U.S.'s economy, 2% of the U.S.'s economy. And when markets refuse to loan to Greece, Greece doesn't have the options that the United States does. Is this unfair? Absolutely, it's unfair, but this is the situation, and it's what makes the Greek problem so enormous in terms of the Greek government and the Greek people being able to solve it.
There's a strange sort of a bit of irony here, Richard, where the prime minister from a dozen European countries, including the United Kingdom, wrote a letter Monday to the EU president and the European Commission president as well, saying that they were worried that more austerity could exacerbate Greece's problems by putting a stranglehold on growth and therefore making it impossible for them to pay back these loans that they're now negotiating. That strikes me as a little ironic, given what Cameron has done to the United Kingdom. I mean, I noticed a piece by Paul Krugman today in the New York Times about this kind of religion of austerity that has substituted moralizing for analysis and fantasies for lessons of history.
Well, look, I mean, I'm with Professor Krugman on this one. I think that the Europeans are making a grotesque mistake in calling for more and more austerity. Greece is a small and fragile economy at this point, and it feels very broken in spirit. And the willingness of investors to invest or businesses to expand or consumers to spend at this point is non-existent. I mean, the economy keeps contracting. Now, part of that problem is that the European economy has contracted. It didn't grow the way it was expected to in 2011. And some of the projections that were assuming that Greece could move back to growth itself this coming year were dependent on Europe growing. As a consequence, one of the problems for Greece is not only the burden which this austerity program places on it, but also the fact that the wider European economy is not growing. A third of Greece's economy depends on shipping and tourism, and shipping is still at the bottom of the barrel. The standard measure of shipping health, the shipping industry's health, is something called the Dry Baltic Index, which measures the cost of renting or leasing freighters to move freight, and it's at about 10-12% of the level it was at just 4 years ago, and it has not started climbing back yet. And until it does, a major sector of the Greek economy is going to continue to exist on life support. The second is that tourism is a huge sector for Greece, and for 3 years it declined steadily, which was terribly damaging. Now, in terms of total tourists, last year, tourism was up, but of course, all the television images and the talk of rioting in Athens means that the tourism right now is asymmetrical. People are trying to fly wherever possible onto individual islands or anything that they can do to avoid actually going to Athens. Tourism in Athens is down again. Tourism in the outer islands is starting to rise. But again, overall, you need a dramatic increase in tourism and in shipping to get the economy moving again. The third factor is that Greek exports, while they have risen, need to rise even more dramatically in order to close what's called the current account balance, basically the gap between exports and imports. Greece is still importing substantially more than it's exporting, and this is putting pressure on the economy as well, too. So you have a situation in which the Greek economy, because of the larger economy of Europe, plus specific factors having to do with major sectors of the Greek economy, plus the austerity program, are making it impossible for Greece to foreseeably get back to healthy growth.
But what explains this, Richard Parker, that irresponsible lenders, the banks who made these bad loans, are not punished, and the irresponsible borrowers in terms of governments are punished in the sense that they get voted out, and the previous conservative government in Greece were the ones that made a lot of these irresponsible loans, and we know that Goldman Sachs helped them disguise their sovereign debt. So the people who actually get punished are the Greek people, and that seems to be a pattern, given that so much of what's happening in Greece and Ireland is really they're at the Great Depression levels in terms of economic pain, and Spain with 23% unemployment, 50% amongst the young. Britain's economy has had its longest slump since the 1930s. I know we did something similar here. We Main Street suffered in order for Wall Street to be revived and now flourish. But what explains that that kind of paradox or disconnect?
Well, I mean, I think it's the asymmetry of power in the United States and the fact that the distributing the pain but capturing the gain is much the way that these economies operate when crises like this arise. I don't think that that's a shocking claim, but it's one that really is not discussed openly in most of these economies or most of these countries. And in fact, you have people who are being elected on these platforms of austerity across Europe and in the United States. I mean, the Republicans made unprecedented gains in terms of the Congress in 2010, running on a program of more austerity, more austerity, more austerity. Cameron was elected on a program of austerity. This may originate within a small and well-to-do class within each of these societies, but for complicated reasons, they seem to be able to find a significant portion of the total voting population willing to buy this story. And I think that's a difficult situation.
So it's the economic illiteracy of most people thinking that somehow the house, just as you're supposed to pay your household debts, that somehow the national debt is out of control, and not realizing that they've obviously don't know about Keynes and some of the basic facts of economics, and who's out there teaching them, you know.
Not enough people, apparently, because to judge from the results, the information is not getting through.
So what do you think the impact will be then on... I've never been able to understand why the Europeans haven't been able to get their hands around this crisis. It's dragged on for over 2 years. The longer it drags on, the more expensive the bailouts become. Many people have said that Obama's re-election fate may well be in Merkel's hands. Already we've got a recession in Europe. Do you think it's going to impact the elections here, given the extent to which the Obama administration are trying to feel good about recent economic good news, if that's what it is, here in the United States?
Well, I think it'll have an effect. I mean, again, I'm not a political scientist, but I mean, anyone looking at the way the Republican primaries are going, how at the same time has to say, what Merkel might take away from Obama, Rick Santorum may deliver. I mean, if Santorum or someone like him were to get the nomination, I think it's a fair to say bet to say that Obama would be reelected. There's the ancillary problem, however, of what the composition of Congress would look like, because obviously with a Republican House and still an ongoing possibility, even if Obama wins, that the Senate will pass to the Republicans, this means that we'll have gridlock in the United States, which will only complicate this problem of austerity in the West that we're facing right now.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Richard Parker.
Ian, it's good to talk with you, as always. I wish I came with good news and simple answers.
Well, I'm sorry to say that this is the way the world is, and I guess there's no point in being Pollyannish about it.
No, I don't think we should. I think we need to face what we're facing and recognize it and struggle on.
Again, I thank you for joining us, Richard Parker. And Richard Parker teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. He was an economic advisor to the previous Papandreou government in Greece and is an advisor to the current Greek government. Yeah.
زخ رصاص على الناس العزل يا حيف واطفال بعمر الورد اعتقلن كيف زخ رصاص على
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bilal Saab, who is a visiting fellow at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute for International Studies. Previously, he was a research analyst at the Brookings Institution and has conducted research on political and economic development in the Middle East at the Middle East Institute and on post-conflict reconstruction in Iraq at the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He has an article at CNN, Why Damascus Remains Eerily Calm. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bilal Saab.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you, Ian.
And it is obviously eerily calm in the center and in the capital of Damascus, although there was some substantial demonstrations on Friday in the outer suburbs, I believe, where the military opened fire. How close did they come to the center, those demonstrations?
Well, they got pretty close, but it's a little bit still away from central Damascus. It's interesting, as soon as I wrote the article, it was, I think it was only a day or so when I heard news of the increasing protests and the escalating violence in the suburbs. But keep in mind that last month we did see some agitation and some demonstrations in several suburbs of Damascus. But yet again, it wasn't close enough to central Damascus.
But the point of your article at CNN, Why Damascus Remains Eerily Calm, is that there that unlike Libya, Tunisia, and Egypt, where the societies united against their oppressors and their dictators, Syrian society has yet to unite and is still divided, and it seems to be divided fairly exclusively along the Sunni. Sunnis are the ones involved in the armed rebellion.
That's correct. It's foolish to deny that there are obvious sectarian connotations to the Syrian uprising. Certainly that doesn't mean that the grievances of the Syrian people are not genuine and they are similar to ones felt by Egyptians, Tunisians, and other Arabs who have revolted against their national governments. But that sectarian dimension of the Syrian uprising is hard to miss. And for me, that tells me that it could be a big obstacle to why Syrian society has yet to fully unite, as well as the opposition, against their oppressors. It might be only a matter of time before they do that. I do realize that the Syrian opposition has moved forward in overcoming some of their divisions, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
So you mentioned in your article that the internationally recognized Syrian opposition figures such as Michel Kilo and Haytham Mana refused to join the Istanbul Syrian National Council, which is the umbrella body that is the political arm, if you will, and I guess the military arm is the Free Syrian Army. Explain to us who these people are and why they don't, if they're prominent opposition figures, why haven't they joined the movement?
Well, I mentioned the names of these two individuals simply because they have been leaders in their own right in their opposition against the Syrian regime. And they have really been recognized by not only Syrians, but also the international community. So those were really two important examples. Just for me to show the real divisions that are happening within the opposition itself. Michel Kilo has been portrayed as sort of the grandfather of the Syrian opposition, and he has been opposing the regime for a very long time. A quite prominent intellectual, very well known inside the country, very well respected. The reasons why, for example, he hasn't joined the Syrian National Council is because of some real disagreements on some of the issues that the Syrian National Council has taken, for example, external intervention. There's been some voices inside the Syrian National Council calling, perhaps in the beginning, for more forceful overt international intervention against the regime, something that Michel Kiel has stood against. The role of the Arab League, perhaps having more faith in holding negotiations with the Syrian regime, something that the SNC has been adamantly against. The same goes for Haitham Manah, who's been a very prominent human rights lawyer, and who has been really at the forefront of the opposition against human rights violations by the regime. And just like Kilo, Haitham, not only is prominent on the street, but he has really led his own coordinating body. It's called the National Coordinating Body, and he's based inside the country. The problem with the SNC is that it's based outside the country, and those, for that reason, it has lost some of its legitimacy, perhaps credibility, in the eyes of the Syrian people who are fighting on a daily basis on the ground. So the fact that these two people, in addition to a few others, but these are the two most prominent ones, that they haven't really embraced the SNC, tells me that there's still a lot of work to be done before a so-called opposition movement really speaks with one voice and brings its cause to the international community, and the international community will feel more confident actually to intervene and provide more effective assistance.
Again, I'm speaking with Bilal Saab, who's a visiting fellow at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute for International Studies. He has an article at CNN, Why Damascus Remains Eerily Calm. But surely you could make the opposite argument, couldn't you, about opposition within Syria? If you're an opposition figure within Syria and you haven't been killed, doesn't that open you up to suspicion? Because that's how the Assads have operated over the decades. They either kill you or they co-opt you.
That's very true. You know, I've heard a lot of suspicions that, some of the opposition figures and bodies that have been operating on the ground have been nothing more than mouthpieces for the Syrian regime. And that's very true. But to call Haitham Manah and Michel Kiel as mouthpieces for the Syrian regime is not only wrong, but it's completely unfair. These are really genuine opposition figures that even the SNC itself would consider as nothing less than really leading the forefront of the being at the forefront, basically, of the struggle for freedom and against tyranny. But you're absolutely right. There are a lot of bodies on the ground that the regime sponsors, that the regime supports, and has them there simply doing their own bidding. That's absolutely correct.
So what's going on with Michel Kiel and Haitham Manah in terms of their relationship to the Syrian government? Why are they allowed to operate if they're credible voices for the opposition?
I think Haitham Manah and Michel Kiel are red line for the regime, simply because they have gained international recognition, international legitimacy in the eyes of all those who basically long for democracy in Syria. So for them to lock them in or perhaps, arrest them, assault them, would really bring significant cost to the Syrian regime. I mean, you might ask me at this point, what would they really lose? At the end of the day, they are, fighting an existential war against their opponents. Perhaps that might change. They might lock them soon. But they, in a very bizarre way, they see these two individuals as representing less of a threat to them because these two individuals have not completely given up hope on finding some sort of a political solution to the crisis, i.e. maintaining some sort of a dialogue and negotiations for leading a transition to a new future, basically. The Syrian regime does not really see them as a major threat. It actually sees the rebels as a threat and perhaps also the SNC as a much bigger threat.
So there have never been any serious efforts on the part of the regime. They've rhetorically talked about reform for forever, never enacted it. And when the first rebellion took place, which was a mild, non-violent protest, they cracked down brutally. At this point, they're still talking about a referendum that nobody in the opposition takes seriously. I don't know about the two figures that we've been talking about. Now they've, you know, obviously they're getting support from Russia and China. In fact, the Chinese People's Daily has a front page editorial today castigating the West for stoking a civil war, and the International Red Cross or the Red Crescent trying to get into Syria to create a humanitarian corridor as the city of Homs is besieged, and there's a humanitarian catastrophe taking place there. So it's difficult not to imagine how this thing is not already a civil war. What's your reading on it, Bilal?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I have been saying for the past few months even that we are already in a state of civil war. You might not see the same events that we saw in 1975, 1990, Lebanon civil war, but the country is clearly divided along sectarian lines. The death toll is rising. The sectarian assassinations are evident, and the escalation on the ground is also obvious. It is perhaps not a full-blown civil war, but it's a sort of a gradually escalating civil war that that is as scary and as violent as a civil war that basically we saw in other countries in the Middle East. The reforms that you mentioned about, or the efforts to implement reforms by the Syrian regime, are merely symbolic. I mean, Assad at the end of the day needs to show his allies, primarily the Chinese and the Russians, and he needs to show them that he's a little bit serious about reform. He needs to provide them with diplomatic ammunition that the Russians and the Chinese can use at the Security Council to tell the United States and the others that, look, our friend in Bashar al-Assad is actually trying to implement reform, but he's unable to given the escalating violence on the ground. This is absolutely ridiculous. The regime is, for all sorts of reasons, structurally speaking, the very structure of the regime, is incapable of implementing genuine reforms, because if they do, they're out of power. So that is the paradox that you see in the behavior of the Syrian regime. It needs to show the world, and especially its allies, that it is trying to implement reform. But those reforms are really bogus. They're not real, they're symbolic, and they're used as propaganda to send a message to the world that Bashar al-Assad is trying, but he's simply incapable. He has to crack down on these so-called terrorists and armed gangs first.
So in your article, Bilal Saab, at CNN, Why Damascus Remains Eerily Calm, you point out the paradox that all these other revolutions that have taken place in Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya, you point out that these are the major capitals, that's, you know, the revolution always starts with the sort of educated elite in these capitals and spreads out to the provinces. Now you have the reverse in Syria, where the uprising started on the border with Lebanon in the little port town Deraa, I believe,
right.
And then it's stayed in these other cities around the country. But so far, in Damascus and Aleppo, which is an Alawite city, have largely been untouched. Explain that paradox, if you will.
Well, it doesn't necessarily have to start in the capital, but if you look at the history of, the recent history of these three cases that you mentioned, whether it's Egypt, Libya, or Tunisia, and modern history of Europe, there's a specific point in those social revolutions when they hit the capital. And this is where things get really serious and the departure of the national government is imminent. Why we haven't seen that in Damascus yet, it's a little bit unclear. I mean, the Syrian people haven't been able to reach that critical mass that everybody talks about. We have discussed, you and I, the divisions within Syrian society. But central Damascus has been, like I say in the article, eerily calm. It's disappointing, obviously. But I talked to a lot of Syrians who pretty much share the same feelings and the thoughts that I wrote in the article. And they tell me it's a matter of time, but it might take longer than we all think. There's some homework, like I mentioned, that needs to be done first in terms of rallying the troops, unifying the opposition, some sort of coordination that needs to take place between the rebels who are actually fighting on the ground and those who speak political and who are based in Istanbul. There needs to be some sort of better coordination between the two. Absent all these, I call them social processes, social mobilization processes, Damascus is destined to remain calm. And it's quite unfortunate because it has to, if it doesn't have to start in Damascus, it has to end in Damascus. Because this is when we all figure out and realize that the days of Bashar al-Assad are numbered. At this point, it is really calm, and a large segment of Syrian society that includes the merchant class, those who have wealth, and those who do business with the regime, they're still siding with the regime. And a lot of ethnic minorities who are very much concerned about the future of Syria, should it be ruled by Islamists, and I'm talking about the Christians mainly, that ethnic communal group is very much on the fence, not necessarily siding with the regime, but it's very much concerned about what would happen next. So it is staying home, not really joining the protest movement, and that all is just bad news for that critical mass that I just mentioned. They cannot really reach Damascus in large numbers, if at all, if they don't have that critical mass that everybody's waiting for. The images of Tahrir Square that we saw in Cairo have yet to be replicated in Damascus.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Bilal Saab.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Bilal Saab, who is a visiting fellow at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute for International Studies. Previously, he was a research analyst at the Brookings Institution and has conducted research on political and economic development in the Middle East at the Middle East Institute and on post-conflict reconstruction in Iraq at the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He has an article at CNN, Why Damascus Remains Eerily Calm. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the prison breakout in Mexico.
Intelligence agency takes weight faithfully. The finest type of China, white and cocaine you'll see. Honey, I'm home. Never mind when your bank account suddenly grown. It's funny, we're so out of this debt for this money we owe with ya. When have I told you that I had two governments overthrown to keep our son enrolled in a private school and to keep our tummy swollen? Come on, our home was built on a foundation of bloody throats. The hungry stolen of their souls. Of course, this country's running coke. I took a stunning oath to hush the ones who know. The CIA conducts the flow for these young hustlers that lust for dough.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Joan Grillo, who has covered Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS's NewsHour, the Houston Chronicle, CBC, and the Sunday Telegraph. He's currently a correspondent for Reuters covering the drug war in Mexico and has witnessed military operations, mafia killings, and cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador. He's the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joan Grillo.
Thank you for having me on.
And this prison break up in Monterey, apparently the 30 members of the violent Zeta drug cartel stabbed and bludgeoned 44 members of the rival Gulf cartel. And then that was a sort of a cover for a mass escape, which I think pretty clearly has implicated some of their prison authorities. Already the prison director and three other officials have been fired, along with 18 prison guards. Having seen this war up close, Joan, the Zetas are truly amongst the most violent, and it does seem that every time you hear of incidents in Mexico, it's hard to believe the level of brutality. What does this mean with all of these incredibly violent people now on the loose? Is this any worse, or is this just another day in the drug war?
No, I mean, certainly every incident we have to take very seriously. And it's, I know that the level of violence has been so horrific here. Like you say, it's very hard to get complacent about these kind of horrific incidents. And suddenly 44 people being, you know, stabbed, bludgeoned to death, it no longer is, you know, a big story. So it's like, oh, you know, one more massacre in Mexico, so what's new? No, I mean, I think everything is very important. Now, this is actually the worst prison massacre in Mexico during the 5 years of President Felipe Calderon's campaign against drug gangs, and one of the worst prison massacres in its history. If you can imagine in a U.S. jail, 44 people being, you know, killed with short weapons, that would, you know, absolutely be stunning the whole world. So imagine the severity there. Now, as well as that, it is one more example of how the machinery of government is just failing to contain these people. Now, prisons themselves have shown themselves to be a real time bomb. You've got these prisons, which are often state prisons like this one, not federal institutions, but state institutions, which really don't have the staff to kind of keep guard of these seasoned killers. And then you have so many assassins and cartel members being arrested and packing these jails that it's overwhelming the guards and the security in these places, overwhelming them with the force and overwhelming them with the money and power they have. Often the guards, you know, as they say, the old example of Brumor Plata, the lead of a bullet or the silver of a bribe for these guards is under a very difficult choice for guards working in these institutions. So again, you see the prisoners, 30 of them left, and now, you know, after carrying out these massacres, are now at large doing these kind of activities. And other examples in prisons where more than 100 prisoners have escaped on single days. So again, Mexican prisons are not proving very good at holding or containing these inmates or the violence.
Well, but doesn't it sort of point, Joan Grillo, to the kind of dysfunctional nature of this war on drugs? If 30 to 40,000 people have been killed in this drug war, and the police have been clearly compromised, and the Zetas themselves, this violent gang, come out of an elite military unit, and they, most of the time they get away with murder, but when occasionally they're caught, they're able to escape en masse, it just seems completely broken, the system.
Well, it certainly is. I mean, the number you pointed out, it's now become even higher. The latest number says that more than 47,000 people in total have been killed in drug-related violence since Felipe Calderon came to power. So, yes, this does shine a big spotlight on the war on drugs. This is an attack on drug cartels and drug trafficking organizations. You know, an attempt to seize and to burn down, to prohibit, to stop drug trafficking at the source. The tactic has been developed, you know, through assistance with the United States over several decades. This really shines a light on that whole strategy of trying to prohibit and try and stop drugs. And obviously, in the case of Mexico, things have got very bad. Now, it's gone beyond drugs in Mexico right now, because these organizations, they make billions of dollars trafficking heroin and crystal meth and marijuana and cocaine to Americans. They now use that money to create private armies with the real power to overwhelm the state. And they've moved into other activities. They're financed by drugs, but they've now moved into mass kidnapping, into extortion of businesses, even to stealing oil from Mexico's state oil monopoly, Pemex. They steal now $2 to $4 billion worth of oil every year. So it really is a critical situation, one of the worst drug wars in the history of, you know, drug culture and drug taking. And it really is a wake-up call to the world and the United States about what is happening in this country and among these policies.
There have been obviously a lot of friction between the Mexican government and the United States government over the war on drugs, where the Mexican authorities feel they're bearing the brunt of a war which there, you just mentioned the figure of 47,000 people have died in order to keep drugs flowing to their American customers. And we have this kind of attitude over here that there's some immaculate way that the drugs cross the border, and if there's only organized crime south of the border, there's no organized crime north of the border. And what the Mexican authorities complain about are the firearms that flood in from the United States into Mexico. I believe they've been putting up billboards near the U.S. border, haven't they, saying no more guns.
So that's correct. They actually made a sign out of guns. They got some people to hand in firearms. They're programming with people, you know, handing in firearms in their house, and they crush all these weapons and use them to make a big thing saying, you know, a movement against violence and saying no more guns, you know, and facing the United States. And it is true, they have a very powerful point that an enormous amount of firearms are coming from gun shops, particularly in Texas and in Arizona, and where you can go to those shops and you can buy versions of the Kalashnikov assault rifle, which is the most popular weapon among Mexican drug cartels. They use the Kalashnikovs to spray rounds off, and these murder scenes which I've arrived at, you can see 300 to 500 bullets from these Kalashnikovs. They kill not only the targets that are after, but also the person driving behind, the person setting tackles on the side of the street, and many other people in these scenes. Now, Kalashnikovs are manufactured, obviously originally a Russian rifle, and now manufactured in many countries, including Hungary and China and so forth, and in the United States itself, but they're sold largely in gun shops in the United States. Another common weapon of drug cartels in Mexico is the AR-15 assault rifle, the so-called civilian version of the M-16. And again, that's manufactured in the United States and sold in these gun shops in large quantities in Texas and in Arizona. And from there now, there was arguments sometimes about the percentages of weapons originating in the United States in the hands of Mexican drug cartels, and they've now traced more than 60,000 seized in recent years. That's the ones they've seized and captured. So we can say whatever the exact percentage is. I mean, weapons do come from other sources as well. There's weapons which are stolen from the Mexican military. There's weapons which are stolen from militaries in Central America and smuggled up to Mexico and used in this conflict. But we can say for certain that there are tens of thousands of guns being bought in American stores and being used to commit brutal murder in this country.
So, Joan Grilla, here in the United States, we're responsible for, we're the customers for the drugs. We supply the arms, or at least a large portion of the arms that are responsible for the 47,000 deaths in Mexico. And yet we, you know, in effect, blame Mexico, and somehow our hands are clean, even though we're, it's our money and guns that are driving this war. It's got to be incredibly frustrating for Calderon to in effect, be bearing the brunt of America's war on drugs. He's the one that's paying the political price, isn't he?
Well, he certainly is paying the political price. I mean, he also made, he took a choice to accelerate this. He made certain choices in his when he entered office. There's different ways of fighting the war on drugs. There's presidents who uphold the law but don't, but Calderon took a step further and went from just, you know, saying we're going to uphold the law and arrest traffickers here and there to willing to declare war, the very martial language used from when he entered office. One of his first moves was to dress up in a military uniform to go to a military base and address soldiers and use the kind of language like there'd be no quarter, no, you know, on the enemies of the fatherland and this kind of thing. So he did raise the stakes. In some ways, you know, he raised the climate in this country, and it wasn't successful. Perhaps he'd hoped for a kind of the same thing that happened during Ronald Reagan's administration, where Ronald Reagan sent gunboats down to Florida and kind of declared and spoke about, you know, fighting the cocaine barons in Miami. And after a couple of years, that was the kind of situation that kind of gone off the agenda, and he moved on to other things. But in this situation, it really came back in his face, and no one predicted this conflict coming. I mean, if you asked anybody back, you know, 5 years ago, you know, I've been covering this country for 11 years, and when Calderon first came in, we just had no idea we would suddenly come into this armed conflict which would produce such devastation. I mean, as well as knowing the total numbers, just the kind of incidents we've seen, like mass graves with more than 200 bodies, a single massacre of 72 people, including a pregnant woman, and all kinds of horrific things that have passed during this conflict in the last 5 years.
So, So, in specifically, Johan Grillo, in terms of this prison break outside of Monterrey, where 30 members of the Zetas drug cartel escaped and they killed and bludgeoned to death 44 members of the rival Gulf cartel. And as we mentioned, the head of the prison and various other authorities have been arrested on suspicion of complicity. That doesn't come as a great surprise. But what's actually going on within the war on drugs, and that is the war between the Zetas, who evolved out of an elite military unit, and the Gulf cartel? Because my understanding is that El Chapo Guzman, the head of the Gulf cartel, is pretty much the capo di capo, isn't he? He's the number one guy in terms of the cartel leaders.
Well, yeah, you've had this this changing war, this moving scenario between these different warlords and these different armies of drug cartels. And as you said, the Zetas emerged originally back in the late 1990s. They were recruited by the head of the Gulf cartel, who at the time was called Osiel Cardenas. And he recruited these people to be a private army to protect him. Back in the early 90s, the drug war was fought by street gang members, often some of them from California. Some of them were kind of Mexican-Americans from California who went over and recruited, guys with tattoos and shaved heads and pistols. But the Zetas were actually military guys who were recruited by that person, and they formed this militia. And that really started to militarize this conflict in this country, because when they had a militia and began to fight with real firepower, with real military tactics, all the rest of the cartels felt they had to have the same tactics to stand the ground in this war. Now, as the Zetas became so powerful, they grew and grew and grew. And they recruited members all around Mexico, and even over the border in Guatemala, down to El Salvador, Honduras, and really started reaching, being a major reach, moving to other activities, and eventually broke away from the Gulf cartel and formed their own criminal army, which is now one of the most powerful forces in this conflict. I mean, absolutely incredible, the resilience they have, their ability to withstand attacks from other cartels and to fight a conflict on so many different fronts. I mean, these are people who are managing to fight conflicts from Guatemala and then all the way 1,000 miles away in Durango and then in Tamaulipas, and they're managing to maintain funds and really challenge the military and come face to face with the military. Now, Chapo Guzman, who you mentioned, is the other big power in this war. He's running the Sinaloa cartel on the other side of the country, and he's the most powerful single gangster from an old family of gangsters from the mountains, with the kind of old style trafficking Godfather, again, a man of immense power who also stretches, his arm reaches right across down to Colombia and into South America and up to the United States, and again, a very, very powerful figure. So really, we haven't seen, despite all this violence, we haven't really seen a weakening in the overall power of drug trafficking organizations and their capacity to traffic drugs, to recruit people, or to confront the forces of the state.
So, Johan Grillo, the Sinaloa cartel headed by Chapo Guzman and the rival Gulf cartel, they've been at it, and now the Zetas are who originally, as you have told us the story, were recruited by the Gulf cartel, and now they become a cartel and a force unto themselves. Are they do distribute drugs along with the other two, or are they specializing in kidnapping and brutality? I'm trying to get a sense of the differences between the cartels, if any.
Sure, the Sinaloa cartel, which has its roots going back all the way back to the kind of early 20th century when Washington first made drugs illegal. They have their roots there in the opium growers of the Sierra Madre Mountains. That there was never been a major drug trafficking organization. The Zetas, who began as a militia, they broke away from the Gulf cartel. The Gulf cartel, to survive now, have ended up allying with the Sinaloa cartel and becoming almost a front for the Sinaloa cartel against the Zetas. Now, the Zetas, as well as the mass kidnapping and extortion, they also do continue the main business of trafficking drugs. And there's been various Zeta people moving, court moving quantities of marijuana, crystal meth, cocaine, and so forth. They didn't have the same kind of contacts in Colombia, the same ability always to move these transnational shipments, but they're getting more, you know, they're definitely getting very powerful at controlling territory on the ground, and it appears more and more capable in the international trafficking of drugs.
So how does this impact the upcoming elections? My understanding is that the pre-party is making a comeback, perhaps out of exhaustion with the war on drugs, that the Mexican people feel. It seems an irony that, given the history of the corruption in the pre-party, in many ways when they're in power, they kind of quietly regulated the drug cartels. They you know, protected them and took their money and kept the peace. So it's an awfully sort of cynical irony, is it not, that the Mexican people could elect a government that has always been in complicity with the cartels and reject a government that is trying to clean up Dodge, if you will.
Well, I mean, that's one way to understand things. I mean, actually, the corruption relationship of government and corruption in Mexico is complicated. There's definitely a lot of corruption during the years of the PRI. I mean, it changed during decades and during different administrations. Sometimes there's accusations of it running right up to the presidents themselves. Now, other times, it's more of a system of corruption at lower levels. But there's continued to be accusations of corruption under the present government. We've also got accusations of corruption. I mean, the government itself is still saying, well, a lot of people, police, are on the payroll of drug cartels, and not only are acting to turn a blind eye, but are even acting as foreign assassins and kidnappers for these cartels. And there's some people who, you know, accused even the high levels of this government could be in cahoots, where they haven't found conclusive evidence of that happening. So it's probably a bit of a simplification to say there was a kind of sudden change, but the people in Mexico are indeed fed up. Many people do say, well, we were better off under the days, during the days of one-party rule, under the PRI, who ran Mexico from 1929 till 2000. We were better off then. There was less insecurity. There was, you know, we felt better. We felt more secure in our homes, in our houses. We didn't have fear of going out at night and being in a crossfire, people firing at each other. We didn't worry about being kidnapped for ransom. So yeah, there's definitely that concern coming. We'll see if the PRI wins the election. We've got some other interesting candidates as well. And if the PRI does win the election, we'll still see if they are capable of restoring order and of reducing the violence in this country.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Johan Grillo.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Johan Grillo, who's covered Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS NewsHour, the Houston Chronicle, CBC, and the Sunday Telegraph. He's currently a correspondent for Reuters covering the drug war in Mexico and has witnessed military operations, mafia killings, and cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador. He's the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.